Following program has been furnished and paid by Nathan P. Ross, CPA, and KSEV is not responsible for its content or the products or services offered.
Welcome to the Be a Planner Show with Nathan Ross, CPA, a show that helps you learn how planners can generate significantly more wealth now. Nathan will answer your questions about business or personal finance, or how to increase current cash flows and generate retirement savings to make sure you're on the right path, and so much more. Whatever your financial goal, Nathan can get you there faster. And now, here's your host, Nathan Ross.
Welcome to this week's Be a Planner Show with Nathan Ross, CPA, and I also have my associate Dan DuBose coming on. Dan, are you there yet?
Sure.
Okay, great. Glad to have you again this week.
Sure.
Let me see here. We're going to have Amy on later today again. She's got gathered some questions for us. I suspect we'll have more come in real time today with the topic. We've got a lot to discuss today. We're looking forward to talking again about planning and some entity structures that we like that we're using with more and more of our clients. So anyway, Dan, did you have anything from the news this week you wanted to share? I mean, we've been busy head down doing tax returns, so I know you haven't probably spent much time.
I'm still working on a tax return, yeah, so that's the news from this side. Get taxes
okay.
done.
Well, the only news I've seen is bad news, it seems like. The inflation issue, the new jobs number, which they're anything but new jobs, right, Dan? What are they really? What are we really seeing happen in the job space? We're basically catching up, right? There's been no real new job creation. We had so many taken away from us by the government shutdown that we're still trying to climb out of that hole. In any event, but even the retrenching, I guess, those numbers were down. And, of course, that caused a little bit of a blip in the market. But anyway, the American economy ultimately is resilient, and there's no question, I think. Even now, there's certain indicators that don't seem to fit the normal recessionary status that I think, you know, the maybe not the technical, but the informal criteria we met a while ago of two straight quarters of decline. GDP
technically
decline,
is what they call it. Yeah, if we have two declining quarters, then there's a recession.
Yeah. So, but there's conflicting signals. But there's one thing that's not conflicting. And it's the impact of inflation, as it seems, and it's seen in many segments across the economy, and with this past week's OPEC, I guess that's the big news, right? Is the OPEC, what are they calling it now? OPEC Plus, to include Venezuela and Russia? Are those the two outliers that aren't, quote, Saudi enough? Is that the way to define it? But in any event, they're talking $100 a barrel oil again, and so I guess that's good for some. It's bad for others. I would hate to live in Europe in a cold area, which I think most of it is, right? And know that you don't have some good supply lines in place for the heating oil and other energy sources that are used to keep warm. And I think that's something that maybe a few of those leaders forgot when they were beating their chest about blunting the effect of Putin. By the way, I saw where with the current, maybe it's before the current rise in oil prices that Putin is collecting essentially $1 billion a day from the sale of oil. Is that not amazing, Dan?
That is amazing.
And to my to a little bit to what I spoke of months ago, that, you know, these sanctions that we put in place back then, I called them these sanctions because they were proposed, were going to help Putin, not hurt him. And I mean, I guess when you effectively restrict supply, prices go up. And if there's an offset, well, you're better off, right? It's amazing how that he's stayed in lockstep. It seems like each time they cut or further constrain him or seek to constrain him, the price of oil goes up to match whatever the loss was that he just incurred, right? So I don't know. I'm not sure what the answer is. I'm not a politician, but I tell you, I don't think the guys in Washington have any idea either. Anyway, hey, before we keep going, Dan, let's mention that, we're going to be talking tax strategies again today. We're also going to talk a little bit about why we like to invest in at least commercial. Well, I guess it's real estate in general, but certainly commercial real estate is what we think the sweet spot is. But we don't want you running out and trying to DIY these strategies without checking with your current advisors. Very important to get their inputs. They alone understand your current facts and circumstances to understand what, if anything, that we say that you might find appealing can actually be implemented. And if you don't have current advisors that understand real estate private partnerships or real estate acquisitions in general, single family, or maybe you want to buy some real estate notes, or perhaps you want to wholesale some properties or flip some properties. Well, those are things that we've done for the most part and know exactly how it works from both an investor standpoint as well as a tax professional. So if you want to work with us or see if we can accommodate your objectives, go to our website at baplanner.com. That's BEAPLANNER.com, where you can top right of that website homepage, you can see intake forms, a link there for intake forms, and a link for schedule a call. And that's all you need to connect with us. If you'll please fill out the intake forms, we will have enough data at that point to perhaps give you some specific answers to some of your questions. And we for sure will be able to tell you, after we listen to your objectives, we'll be able to tell you how we can help you. For those of you that may be joining us late, you're listening to the Be a Planner Show with Nathan Ross, CPA. And I have my associate, Dan DuBose, CPA, also here on the line. And if you would like to ask a question or comment about an issue or perhaps give us some idea of a topic you'd like to hear discussed on the show, please send us a text to 713-581-0195, or you can also email us at info@npross.com. That's alphabetically November Papa Roger Oscar Singapore.com. Kind of sounds like Peyton Manning calling a signal there, doesn't it, Dan?
Omaha.
Yeah, with the Singapore. Anyway, okay, so with that said, let's talk about the types of real estate investors that we work with, Dan, and then we're going to talk about the ways we make money with real estate, and depending on how much time we have, we may come back to speak a little bit more about commercial real estate and why we like that space better than most that we look at today. And you know, if you follow what's going on in the single family space, you'll certainly understand. But that said, I know people, in fact, we've got clients that make tens of thousands, even hundreds of thousands of dollars every year off of things like foreclosures or off of things like flips. And so, you know, there's niches out there that I don't care if the market's going up or down. There's a lot of money to be made. And we certainly see that across our client base. But in any event, the thing about commercial real estate is it's got so many ways that we can make money. And, Dan, let's talk about I've identified nine without really thinking too long about it. I know I see certain websites that say there's five ways we make money. Others say six ways we make money. I'm going to suggest they're leaving a few of them on the table, but that's okay. Even if it were three, it would be worth your while perhaps to take a look. But the first very obvious way is we make, well, first of all, cash flow is key, but it's not the only way that we make money. And of course, I guess saying that, ultimately it's all about cash flow, whether it's this year or 5 years from now, and maybe you exit a multifamily project that you invest in and you hold it for, you know, 3 to 7 years perhaps. Ultimately, we're looking at how much cash flow do we generate on that investment. And if you're not looking at that, you're missing the boat. I don't care if you want to say, well, you know, I invested in that property because that is just a trophy asset. Very important that I can tell somebody I've invested in that property. Well, I'm going to tell you, unless it generates cash flow, it's not a trophy. Correct, Dan?
That's right. That's the reason you get there is for not for the trophy effect, but for the cash effect, isn't it?
Well, it's nice when you can accomplish both, but let me just say, if ultimately, and I'm not necessarily talking about years one, two, three, et cetera. I know I've invested in deals where it took 5 years to see the cash flow that was projected, but that was the plan. So, you know, you have to understand that going in. So generally we have cash flow that we look at. Then we have equity accumulation. There's several issues there that create money. And then we have tax savings, several ways we save money on taxes. And we're going to go in at a high level to each one of these. And again, I'm going to remind you what I just said regarding DIY. Can you DIY most of these? You bet you can. And just like I can go buy a Makita saw, circular saw, at Home Depot, and I could probably, in fact, I almost have cut my leg off. So, yeah, you can DIY it on your tax return, and good luck to you. And, you know, you can circle back to us or others in your current world that prepare your tax returns to try to fix it. But sometimes the cows or cats are out of the barn already, right? So in any event, let's talk about, so we've got cash flow from what, Dan? What's the first thing that generates cash flow on a rental property?
Well, rents it would be first, I would believe. You know, you're going to be looking for those people to help you pay that mortgage down by collecting those rents every month.
I agree, and you're already jumping ahead to number six on the list. So staying with number one, it's putting people, tenants, in those empty apartments or upgraded apartments, depending on your strategy, depending on whether you're buying a beat-up old Class C and you're turning it into a, you know, nice C-plus or B-minus property. We call that adding value, and we refer to those projects as value adds. Versus a yield play, which is the type of transaction where you're buying something that's 93 to 95% occupied. It's already generating cash flow. You're not going to have to do heavy rehabs. Maybe you do some cosmetic improvements, and so you basically keep the asset functioning, keeping the cash flow coming in. So what's the second way, Dan, that also involves rents that we are going to make more money on?
Well, when you got that value added, are you not increasing your rents?
Well, that's exactly correct. So once you own something, you control the rental income, which means if you've got a property, as most of the ones are that that our clients are involved with, they're typically, if you've got a property that's not the prettiest, not the nicest, maybe not the best location, doesn't have the Bark Park or the stainless appliance package, the smart home packages, et cetera, that all the new Class A units do, then you may, by changing that, by adding some of those things, you should likely be able to increase the rents. And most of the projects that we see project a, I don't know, anywhere from a 15 to a 20 or 25% rent increase over the first 2-3 years as they're building, they're trying to increase that net operating income, which is how we're able to do a refinance. So in any event, what I just kind of touched on a couple, what are several of the ways that we do enhance these properties to justify that rent increase? Dan?
You know, my daughter, when she lived in an apartment just not very long ago, she really loved her park for her dogs. Bark Park, they call it, I guess, for a cute name. But she really did enjoy that because it was a place for her to, for them not to make a mess everywhere else, but, you know, have a very controlled area for the dogs to play and do whatever they need to do when they get out of the house.
Yeah, I think what all of the things that we know that can be applied here, like laundry room upgrades or maybe in-room washer and dryers, parking, covered parking, or garages that get added. There's you know, storage upgrades. All of it translates to one word, convenience, right? And yeah, you can look at almost every one of these issues, and typically with older properties, you've got to go off-site to walk the dog, to get the storage unit, to put a few things in, to do your laundry, you know, et cetera. So anyway, okay, so those are the cash flow ways we increase our equity, I mean, our increase our net operating income. Now let's talk about equity accumulation, Dan. And I know we see every syndicator in the world. Is there any syndicator, I'm just curious, that pays market for anything? Or do they all claim what, Dan? What are they claiming they're doing in almost every case?
They're going to buy it below fair market value.
Right, below right. Market it's like, man, are there a bunch of stupid sellers out there because they're just selling things below market. What they really mean is they're looking past the acquisition, seeing that they can buy a property that's lacking or isn't beautiful, and make it beautiful, add some of these issues, and at that point, they're at market. They're not saying, in some cases, now in some cases, they are saying, hey, this thing has a comparative or comparable property around the corner that just sold, and it sold for less, or more, I guess, is what it would be, than what we're able to buy this comparable property for. So that happens. I shouldn't act like it never does, but I'm just telling you, sellers aren't stupid. They know. They're surveying the market constantly, trying to figure out how they might execute their exit, which is how they give money back to their investors or to them if it's a corporate owned type deal. So we're going to talk about that. You know, buying below market gives us instant equity, quote unquote. Another way is from when we do the upgrades, that is referred to typically in most syndication talk or private placement memorandums or webinars as forced appreciation, meaning that we're taking a property that has no stainless appliances, has none of the aforementioned amenities, we're adding those amenities, and as a result of doing that, now we've climbed up a notch or two. Maybe we've taken that C class apartment and turned it into a C plus, or maybe it's a C minus or even a D plus, and we've turned it into a C plus or perhaps a B minus, and doing that gives us the ability to sell it for more. It's not just raise the rents, raise the cash flow. Yeah, we have that too. But every time you raise the rents and you get an extra dollar of cash flow to the bottom line, depending on the current cap rate that properties are trading at, that adds what, Dan? Another $5 to $10, not quite 10 yet, although it's coming. You watch. We're going to get there if these rates keep going. It'll add another $5 to $10 in value. And you think about that across 300 units, and it's, you know, you're not just raising it a dollar, you're raising it, you know, several thousand dollars, perhaps, maybe $20,000, $30,000. You divide the cap rate into that number, and it's a pretty big bump in value. And it can happen relatively quickly. And, you know, we see refinances at times that occur a year, maybe a year and a half, 2 years after the acquisition, and people are able to take distributions once they get that higher loan-to-value that might represent 60 to 80% of the initial investment. I mean, Dan, that's why we invest in apartments, correct?
Yeah, that's part of that tax-free money you're going to, or tax-free cash flow you're going to receive.
Well, let's talk about tax-deferred. Let's say it's tax-deferred. There's little of anything is tax-free except those wonderful Roths that we like converting your pre-tax from. Those are indeed tax-free after you pay the conversion tax. But, again, that's a whole other topic, and we won't talk about it this week. We will try to revisit Roth conversions perhaps next week. But bottom line, the way that the multifamily apartment building is valued and traded differs significantly from the way that single-family properties are valued and traded. And, Dan, what's the general scenario on how someone determines what they can sell their single-family rental property for? No matter how well it's run, and I say that in general, generally, no matter how well it's run, you're limited by what, Dan? What's your top cap that you're going to be able to sell at?
What the market is right close by to you, or comparable.
That's right, and that should have a recent in front of it. It is market, but it is a recent, something that sold a month or two ago would typically be the best comp, or even last week. And what's happening right now in the market, Dan? What's going on that's changed significantly on your ability to sell?
Sales values are decreasing in some parts of where I am in Houston, so it's a little bit unnerving for the real estate people, I think, right now.
And so I had
one agent tell me recently that she is seeing quite a decrease in values, and she was at a high level market though too. So it's, you know, that interest rate really affects things, and it's getting into her pocket pretty deep right now, I think.
So it's a series of dominoes, essentially. You know, you've got higher interest rates, which mean lower approvals, right? And I was looking at a stat, I read it off a couple weeks ago. It seems like that about a year ago, at a 2.9% interest rate, a given prospect could qualify for a $620,000 home. Now at a 6.2 interest rate, it's down to where they would qualify for a $390,000+ home. So you're talking a $250,000 adjustment. I'm not sure if the LTV was different. The loan to value probably was, but in any event, I want to just mention, so bottom line is the single family market, boy, the appraisals are going to become an issue again. Remember how that was an issue a few years ago? And you know, you're going to go make it, you're going to list it at one number, and if it doesn't sell in the next 2 days, I mean, almost literally, you're not going to, that appraiser isn't going to value that home at the same value, because things are going to change before you get that first offer. Let's talk about one last equity issue, and then we're going to take a break, and we'll address tax savings when we come back. But there is a certain amount of equity from what we would call natural appreciation, and if you want to understand what that's about, just think about your own property. You maybe bought it 20 years ago, and you have a realtor give you what I would call a pencil appraisal, where they just kind of look at the lay of the land in your area, and you might be shocked to realize that your property has probably doubled at least once, probably more, without you doing anything. You didn't fix anything. You didn't enhance anything. You just laid low, stayed off the radar, and all of a sudden now you've got the benefit of what's been happening for the last 20 years in your neighborhood. And that, I guess, is what we would refer to as natural appreciation. Oh, and I forgot, I skipped over mortgage amortization. You've got those tenants every month sending you money that you can pay your mortgage down with. That's a big one, a big form of equity accumulation. And so in any event, let's go ahead and take a break, and we'll come back in just a very few minutes here, and we'll talk tax savings and a couple other ways we make money, okay, with real estate. We'll be back with more of the Be a Planner Show with Nathan Ross and Dan DuBose, CPAs.
Hey, if you'd like to contact Nathan for questions during the show today or during the week, you can text him at 713-581-0195, 713-581-0195, or you can send an email to Nathan at npross.com, Nathan at npross.com.
The Syndication Math Show with Nathan Ross, CPA, focuses exclusively on helping investors understand the current options for investing. The syndication arena has changed. You can now take advantage of direct online investing options without expensive upfront membership fees. Nathan Ross, CPA, discusses these options and more, including the math involved with partnership selection, reporting, and performance. On the Syndication Math Show with Nathan Ross, CPA, Sundays at 7 a.m. right here on KSEV.
Okay, welcome back to more of the Be a Planner Show with Nathan Ross, CPA, and Dan DuBose, CPA. And just a reminder, if you want to ask a question or otherwise make a comment or suggestion to us, you can send us a text at 713-581-0195 or send an email to info@npross.com. So, Dan, let's pivot and go into the last few ways that we make money with real estate, and that is by using tax savings from assorted types of real estate investment perspectives. And, again, we talked about, we didn't go into great detail, but, you know, the types of investors that can make money in real estate, all of the above, or I guess some of the above, depending on what it is from landlording, from doing either part-time or full-time wholesaling. That would be where we're acquiring the rights to transact a group of properties, maybe never really taking title to them, but we're doing assignments as we go to a closing, or perhaps we're short sellers trying to help people avoid – foreclosure, we're doing some flips in there, or I'm going to say some investment acquisitions that end up selling sooner rather than later because of issues or opportunities that come along. We may buy something thinking we're going to rent it. As I had a client just yesterday tell me that he had a property that he bought it with the intent to rent it, put a for rent sign in the front yard, started rehabbing it, and somebody driving the neighborhood looking for properties offered him an amount of money that basically doubled his $100,000 initial investment. And I mean, he had the property for maybe a month or two. So that happens. And if you know what you're looking for when you acquire something, that might happen more often than later. And by the way, Dan, when we acquire a property, if we've got a choice, let's say we're talking about single family, and this is transitioning us over to the tax savings. When we buy that property, do we want to buy a property that's a blank slate for us? It's sitting there empty. Maybe it's a bombed out hulk of a dwelling. Nobody's living in it. Or would we prefer to buy that property with a rent-paying tenant in it? And I don't necessarily mean from a cash flow perspective, although that certainly is one, but I'm referring to the difference between buying a property that's already ready and available, two keywords, versus sitting there in a dormant state. How would you answer that question? And if you want to, throw you a safety net, I'm happy to do so.
You know, I would think that you'd want one that's got a rent-paying tenant in it already. You know, from a, you know, we've seen it both ways, and it just depends on that particular investor's appetite for work, too, I think. You know, if a guy is willing to get in there and elbow grease it and do a lot of that work for himself, he could make some pretty good equity real quick by just buying a wreck of a house and fixing it up with his own expertise. Or
well,
you can have that guy
generally
that's going to pay all those bills right away.
Yeah, well, you're generally describing a scenario that's not down in the weeds on taxes, but let me just suggest to you that ready and available are the two key words that have to be looked at. And if you buy a property that's the bombed out hulk, everything you do from that point to make it ready and available is capitalized. Even a broken window, even a paint job, these are things that would be repairs if the property had been able to be placed in service already because it was ready and available. So what I'm going to suggest is when you're looking for properties, if you're worried about the tax implications, about achieving those, you want to pick the property. If you're looking at three properties and two of them have people in them, that would be the first indication that they're both ready and available. You would want to pick from one of those two properties so that everything you do after that point becomes at least up for discussion between, is that a repair, which is deductible currently, or is it a capital item? And then you can still look at the tangible bonus depreciation rules that might apply, but that's potentially a big difference. And I've got clients that they know the game now, and they won't touch anything that they can't argue is ready and available. And by the way, it doesn't have to have a tenant in it. The point is, or the issue is, can I rent this thing the day I close on it? And if the answer is yes, without doing significant rehab, then you've got a property that gives you some maneuverability on, you know, current deductions. You agree with that, Dan, or ever?
I do. I think it's, you know, certainly from a tax standpoint, I agree with it. The you know, if you can get that item for which you're paying money, not lots of money, to be deducted currently, so much the better for that particular tax year. That's right.
That's
you
true.
Want it, you and want I an mean, expense those rather than capital item is what we're getting to. You can write it off this year or over 27 and a half years. So.
Well, that's true. And with those tangible bonus rules, you can buy it on the last day of the year and still get significant. significant write-off. Okay, so generally speaking, let's talk about tax savings at a high level. That was a little bit more of a down-in-the-weeds look. In general, I hear people all the time refer to tax-free. In fact, you kind of said it a minute ago, I believe, cash flow, when actually we're talking about tax deferred, meaning that we are going to pay tax on it most likely at some point down the road, unless we execute some of the other tax savings maneuvers, such as a 1031 tax-free exchange, which doesn't eliminate the tax permanently. It's a temporary deferral. It becomes like a snowball that gets bigger as you roll downhill, right, Dan? If
yeah.
you keep 1030, as we say, keep 1031, and then you die. And what happens when you die, Dan, with the tax buildup and the potential gain that might be experienced by your heirs?
Well, they'll get a step up in basis to that, to the fair market value at the date of death. So, you know, you've deferred that gain for these many years through those 1031 exchange till one day you spin in, as an Air Force friend of mine used to say, and your heirs will get that step up in basis.
That's right.
You can sell it the next day and pay no tax on it.
That's right. So the tax does go away in that scenario. But if you're still alive, it doesn't. You still owe the tax at some point, unless, again, you decease with not having ever realized the tax. Now, that's the current law. There's been attempts at changing that. There will probably be future attempts, depending on what happens in November. I would tell you, if you're a real estate investor, this is a great reason to get out and vote for a change in the control of the House of Representatives, at a minimum, and the Senate. Wouldn't be bad. And, you know, I don't think you're going to see an issue like this change by a stroke of the pen or a phone call, as one of our previous presidents used to say. And, boy, in terms of the, quote, elections have consequences, this upcoming election next month is a big one. It's a lot of consequences that can happen if the current Democratic control stays in place or goes up. I mean, it's not just on the tax law front. We've got maybe a Supreme Court packing issue. We've got a filibuster issue. And, you know, I'm telling you, I hate to sound political on the air, but if you can't read the tea leaves, you're not paying attention. Go out to YouTube and just spend 30 minutes listening to the current political videos. But anyway, so let's pivot. I know we didn't really get into the tax area as much as I would have liked, but I've got to move here. Retirement funds, and this is going to be a very short diatribe. This is one, as people listen to the show know, this is one of my favorite topics to discuss. I'm amazed at how many people are unaware that they can tap their existing retirement funds to get started in real estate, including commercial real estate. And, you know, you've got multiple ways now. You don't have to go join like the platform that does the real estate show that comes on before ours. You don't have to join those $20,000 plus investor platforms. They claim and they sound like that, oh, the only way you can invest in these real estate private partnerships is if you join our platform. Well, no, the crowdfunding rules have been out for a while now that the SEC established at the behest of Congress, and you can invest direct with assorted syndicators out in the market. It's no longer a travel agent type scenario where you have to join these old school platforms, and you can invest direct, and we will help you do that. We do not invest your money. We help you analyze opportunities. You alone will make the decision to invest. But the key to remember is when you're hearing loud voices on the air or loud voices from the front of the room, if you show up in person at some of these case study nights with our local platforms, you need to challenge, at least in your own mind, the assertion that you've got to liquidate your retirement accounts and pay a boatload of tax to get started in this very preferred asset space called multifamily real estate partnership syndications. You absolutely do not. You can do everything they're talking about in that seminar or a case study where you control your money, you take control of your money, even from the big 401k plan, without quitting your job, without being 59 and a half, that does require you to be a state of Texas resident and to be married or have a significant other that's a bit more formal than just a boyfriend-girlfriend scenario. And you can access those funds. We'll show you how to do it. We'll provide a referral to legal counsel that can handle it for you. And that will spring what represents most Americans' retirement wealth. That will spring it free where you control it. You can direct it into these real estate private partnerships. The cash flows, profits, et cetera, come back to the retirement plan and grow without taxation. You alone, of every other partner in that partnership, will be able to not pay. You escape the taxation that would occur when you sell or exit out of that property that's involved. And you only pay the tax when you decide, again, you, not your employer, not your HR department, like it's your big company, when you decide you want to write a check to yourself, and of course at that point, you've got to be willing to pay the tax, and if you're under the age of, of 59 and a half, you've got to pay the penalty. But you only pay it on that small piece that you write the check to yourself for. It's not on the entirety of the account, which is what you're going to do. I know it sounds insane, and it is insane if you listen to these professionals, quote-unquote, I'm going to call them amateurs in real life, as Ray Ader called them. They're, you know, when you, if you think the professional tax planners, I'm inserting the word tax planners, if you think the professionals are expensive, just try the amateurs, and boy, is it expensive. $350,000 account. I show an example at the bottom of that baplanner.com website. It translates over 30 years. You lose about $25 million potentially if you had kept it in transactions, earning a 20% per year type return on investment. So if you've got retirement funds, don't fall for it. Go to the baplanner.com website, fill out the intake forms. We will model for you what your go-forward could look like if you simply invested those tax dollars into more transactions. And again, $350,000 sample account would pay about $95,000 in tax if you liquidated it today. By investing that $95,000 in some additional transactions at 20%, that money could grow to about $24.5 million over the next 30 years. That's amazing. Okay, well, I believe Amy has joined us. Amy, are you there?
Yes, I am. Good afternoon. Great. Good afternoon, Mr. Dan and Nathan.
Yes, I hope you're having a good day there in Houston.
Yes.
Amy, we've only got about 10 minutes, a little less than 10 minutes.
Okay.
Why don't you give us a couple questions? I'm hoping maybe we even got some today on these questions. These are some good ones, the topics that we've talked about, so hopefully we've got some good questions.
Yes.
So go ahead.
Real estate investor, the particular real estate investor, and the first question I have with regard to that is how – can a person involved in short sales or flipping houses or flipping any type of investment shield themselves from taxes?
Well, that's a good question, and it involves using the right entity. I'll tell you that. Without the proper entity structure, it's going to be difficult. There's still some things you can try to do, but the bottom line is the tax treatment on flips is determined by your original intent. Might even be like the original sin, no, Dan, I guess, in that sense. what did you intend when you wrote the contract on that property? And, of course, that's kind of dubious. You know, most of my clients say, hey, I saw a good deal. I bought it. I wasn't really thinking, was I going to hold it or was I going to, quote, flip it? And so I'm going to tell you that having the investment intent, which is what I call that, is going to serve you well. But there's some things you got to do to dot your I's and cross your T's. And I'm not going to get into that on the air, but let's just say that, you know, we want to do everything we can from the very beginning, even the way the contract is written, to evidence the intent that we're buying that property as an investment. So that whatever happens after that point, we still can look back and show that intent. And if you, like my client I mentioned earlier, have the good fortune that you're having that property rehabbed for rental and somebody walks up and offers you twice what you paid for it, we don't want you to feel like, oh, well, I can't sell it because, you know, I didn't say I was doing this one as a flip, or maybe I did say it, but I changed my mind and just started and decided this is going to be a great rental property once I got into it. But many of my clients buy properties sight unseen. And so they don't know until after they've acquired it some details where they think, well, you know what, that's really got a great location. It's got whatever amenities that might make it a better single-family rental property than it would a flip where they've got to spend more money on it out of pocket. Typically with a flip, you're going to come out of pocket to make it nice, whereas with wholesaling, we can do a assignment process to avoid putting much, if any, of our own money in it. So anyway, Amy, what's the next question? We still got a few minutes here.
Okay. The other question is also about the short sale and about your favorite topic, retirement funds. So this are you reading my mind here?
I'm worried that this is going to be a little bit oil and water mixture, but we'll try it. Let's go ahead.
Well,
tell me the,
if anybody can do it, Nathan, we know that you can do it.
Good point. Or Dan.
Dan's your backup. He's got your back. Okay. How can retirement funds be used in real estate short sales?
Dan, you want me to handle that, or you want to try a stab at it? Because I'm thinking of several ways.
Well, go ahead.
Okay. Man, you punted it.
Yeah.
Okay. So 2 or 3 minutes here. The first way is your retirement plan. If it's an IRA, self-directed IRA, or a self-directed 401 trust, which is certainly our preference, can acquire that property directly. So you got to be planning ahead. You can't go write the contract as Amy Titus, for instance, and or assigns. You've got to go write that contract as the Amy Titus 401 trust. So from the very beginning, it's got to be positioned and portrayed as the retirement plan being the owner. If you don't do that, you've got a problem if that transaction ever gets looked at, even if you assigned it at closing to the retirement account. That's a prohibited transaction because you can't self-deal with yourself. Now, that's where we buy the property directly with retirement funds, which those are a scenario where you might think, well, you know, you've got to use all the money has to be all the retirement plans. There's no leverage opportunity. And Dan, why do we want leverage real quick?
Increase your yield.
That's exactly right. That's how we make money, is what Dan's saying. For those of you that haven't listened to us in the past, we don't invest in real estate without debt. Otherwise, you're leaving many, many dollars of cash flow potentially, as well as gain on disposition, you're leaving it all or on the table, I guess. You're not getting the benefit of it, however you want to think of that. And we know of lenders, we have lenders out there that our clients have used that will loan money on a non-recourse basis to a retirement account. You're not going to get the same LTV. You're not going to get the same interest rate, but it's all a factor of your underwriting that transaction to make sure that it still makes sense to do business with those costs. And in many cases, it will. Okay, so that's one way. You use the money in the retirement account directly. Another way that we can do with a self-directed 401 trust, only, not the IRA, is we can take a loan of up to $50,000 from the 401 trust to yourself as the participant, and you can use that money for anything you want to use it for. You can take a trip to Tahiti. You can go do a flip where you're put, you know, that's your cash pile that you can use to get the property beautiful. You could host sell if you needed some money for that. That loan does not have to qualify other than you can't already have too much outstanding on other loans. So let's just say it's the first time you take money out of your 401 on a loan, a participant loan, $50,000. You pay about a 1% over the prime rate at the time in interest, and you start making your repayments right away. The next quarter is the longest you can delay that first payment. You can either pay them monthly, you can pay them quarterly. And so that's another way to buy real estate with your retirement funds that most people are totally unaware of. And again, it's one of the perks. There's multiple others involved with doing this transaction from the 401 trust versus the IRA, not the least of which the 401 trust will pay no tax on, well, it won't pay any tax on either of those two methods, but certainly the first one's the one you're concerned about, assuming it's an investment property. So when you sell it, the 401 trust pays no tax. All the proceeds go back to the 401, and unlike the IRA, which will pay the UBIT tax if there's leverage. And so big consideration. But anyway, okay, well, we're less than 2 minutes to the end of the show. And Amy, I want to thank you for coming on to give
My
us those
pleasure.
Questions. Dan, thank you for joining us again today. And for those of you that are listening, don't forget, we've got another show at 7 a.m. tomorrow morning. For all you folks that are attending the two-day workshop this weekend, if you are attending, you know what that means. You know that that's in our building, and you know that we will be talking about what you're going to learn about on Sunday, tomorrow, which is real estate private partnership syndications. We're going to talk about them tomorrow. We'll talk about why you should use your retirement money while it's still retirement money instead of after it's been chopped in half, and to make even more money as you go forward. So anyway, we appreciate you listening to us today, and we look forward to tomorrow or next week in some cases. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Be a Planner Show with Nathan Ross, CPA. Be sure to tune in next Saturday at 5 for another edition of Be a Planner Show here on AM 700 KSEV.